My name is David Fati. I'm director of the ACLU National Prison Project. I've been director of the National Prison Project for 11 years, since 2010. I first started working at the National Prison Project shortly after law school in 1990. I found, and I continue to find, the work enormously compelling to take up for, to defend people who have very few others who will defend them, who will speak out for them, who will advocate for them. And so that's what attracts me to the work, and that's why I've done it for more than 25 years now. Prison censorship is a constant threat. It's a constant reality in the world of prisons and jails. You know, there's a certain amount of censorship that can be defended. I mean, I don't think it's objectionable if prisons want to ban books on lockpicking, bomb making, how to brew wine or alcohol in your toilet. For those kinds of censorship, there is a legitimate security reason, and we don't have an objection to that. But so many instances of prison censorship are just utterly nonsensical. So let me just give a couple of examples. It is common for prisons to ban maps on the theory that they could be used to facilitate an escape. But one prison took that a little too far and banned maps of the moon and other planets on the ground that they could be used in an escape. A federal prison in Colorado banned a prisoner from receiving books by President Obama, citing national security concerns. A different prison allowed Playboy magazine, but banned works by John Updike as too salacious. So we see many, many examples of censorship that really can't be justified on any prison security ground whatsoever, and yet trenches very heavily on the rights of incarcerated people. So there are frequently legal challenges to prison and jail censorship. The Supreme Court has been very clear that prisoners retain First Amendment rights. They are not coextensive with the First Amendment rights of those of us on the outside, but they do continue to exist. And very importantly, the Supreme Court has also said that prison censorship burdens the right not only of the prisoner who can't read what she wants to read, but of the author who is prevented from communicating her message to the incarcerated person by prison censorship. It's important to realize that while prison censorship is often arbitrary and capricious, it is not random. It is not evenly distributed across all forms of literature. It disproportionately targets books by and about people of color, and particularly Black people. So, for example, the Arizona prison system banned Paul Butler's book, Chokehold, Policing Black Men, which is a book by a former federal prosecutor talking about how the criminal justice system systematically criminalizes Black men. That ban was rescinded after the ACLU sent a demand letter, but Arizona continues to this day to ban books by Elijah Muhammad, the founder of the Nation of Islam, and the ACLU and others are challenging that ban. Part of the difficulty of generalizing about anything in U.S. corrections is that you have not only 51 separate prison systems, but you have literally hundreds and probably thousands of local jails, each of which operate independently. So it is really difficult to make general statements. But in terms of censorship of sexual content, there is a range. Most, again, state prison systems that I'm aware of do have some restrictions on pictorial representations of nudity. So, for example, sexually explicit magazines, sexually explicit photographs. The prison system is on much thinner ice if it starts to restrict written depictions of sexual activity, because those restrictions, at least if they're applied even-handedly, would ban the Bible, would ban Lady Chatterley's Lover, would ban all kinds of what everyone would agree is great and important and constitutionally protected literature. So again, there's a lot of consistency in banning sexually explicit photographs, but again, it's much more problematic and much more legally questionable if the prison starts to ban written descriptions of sexual activity. One extreme example of that, again, state of Arizona prison system actually banned court decisions about sexual misconduct by prison staff. These were court decisions describing sexual abuse of incarcerated people by prison staff. And the Arizona prison system banned those on the ground that, well, this is sexually explicit, and so we're going to ban it. That policy was invalidated by a federal court as violative of the First Amendment. It's my anecdotal sense that often the most outlandish and absurd policies turn up in small county jails. So, for example, we challenged a policy in the Berkeley County, South Carolina jail that banned all reading material except the Bible. But because there are, as I said, hundreds, if not thousands of local jails, we can't even keep track of all of these problematic censorship policies, let alone challenge each and every one. And while I said that, you know, often the most outlandish and absurd censorship policies appear in local jails, there are certainly exceptions to that. My favorite example is when the California state prison system banned anything that had been printed from the internet. It didn't matter what the content was. It could be a Bible verse. It could be the text of the First Amendment. If it had been printed from the internet, it was banned. And not surprisingly, a federal court invalidated that policy, but this was a policy that was enacted and enforced for some time by one of the largest correctional agencies in the country. A couple of years ago, Chatham County, Georgia, this is the county that includes the city of Savannah, one day the jail just banned all outside reading material. And as far as we could tell, this wasn't done in response to a smuggling incident or a security breach or really any problem whatsoever. Someone just woke up one morning and decided it would be a good idea to ban all outside reading material. And once we pointed out that this policy was unconstitutional, it was rescinded. But it's striking to me how these policies seem to crop up not in response to any real world need for a restriction, but just because someone thinks it's a good thing to do. And in fairness, you know, sometimes these policies are a response to a real problem. For example, smuggling of drugs or other contraband in magazines or books or reading materials. Now, the censorship or is usually an inappropriate and overbroad and ineffective response, but at least it's responding to some problem that exists in the real world. But so often, these policies are not, and they just seem to spring forth from a reflex to punish, to harm incarcerated people. And I really can come up with no other explanation. I do want to identify an organization that I think has done as much as the ACLU to fight prison censorship, and that is a publication called Prison Legal News. It's a publication that's directed toward incarcerated people, although many non-incarcerated people subscribe also. I subscribe, many lawyers and judges subscribe. And because it reports on issues of interest to incarcerated people, it is frequently censored by prisons and jails, and it has assembled a very impressive track record of successfully challenging prison and jail censorship. And in some cases, the ACLU has represented Prison Legal News in successful challenges to censorship. So, for example, in one case, the Nevada State Prison System banned what they called inmate newsletters, and they applied this ban to censor anything that had been written by an incarcerated person. So the prison writings of Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail, all of these things would have been banned under the policy. And Prison Legal News was also banned under the policy because many of the articles are written by incarcerated people. So we sued the state of Nevada, and eventually the prison system agreed to rescind the ban. When these cases come to the attention of an organization like the ACLU or Prison Legal News, and we do file a lawsuit, we are usually successful in overturning the censorship policy. But again, there are many, many instances that never even come to our attention. And we certainly don't have the resources to sue in every single one of these cases. And at the same time, a 1996 law called the Prison Litigation Reform Act makes it much more difficult for incarcerated people to enforce their rights in federal court. It basically sets up a separate and inferior legal regime that applies only to incarcerated people. So, yes, when these policies are challenged by lawyers who are experts in this field, they're usually overturned, but only a tiny, tiny fraction of these policies are challenged in that way. And so many of them fly below the radar and continue to impinge on the rights of incarcerated people and people on the outside and are never challenged in court. The right to read is so important to incarcerated people. It is so much more important to incarcerated people than it is to most of us on the outside, because they live in such deprived and impoverished environments in prison. And so the ability to have something to read is enormously important to most incarcerated people that I've spoken to. And public figures from Malcolm X to the poet Reginald Dwayne Betts have talked about the importance of reading to them when they were incarcerated. It allowed them to maintain a sense of self, how they were able to educate and improve themselves. And look, we call it corrections for a reason. When we send people to prison, we hope they're going to come out better rather than worse. And making reading as accessible as possible to incarcerated people is one very inexpensive and cost-effective way to improve the odds that people will come out of prison better than when they went in, rather than worse. ¶¶